The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Clouds and rain in the area. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, as the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden is tonight, I'll speak with Emory University professor and author Drew Weston about the psychology of American voters.
When you think about what it is that makes us care about something, most of the time it comes down to some version of survival or our status. It comes down to our kids and our kin, our family, or it comes down to our love of community and care for community.
That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do, the latest data from the State Department of Public Health, which indicates 6,961 COVID-19-related deaths have been reported since March, and there's been 315,281 confirmed cases. Also, 28,197 have been hospitalized, and of those, 5,194 were ICU admissions. This is always according to the State Department of Public Health. And joining me now to discuss the latest coronavirus news nationwide and here locally is WABE health reporter and host of the widely popular podcast, Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam Whitehead. Sam, thanks for taking the time as always.
Thanks, Rose. I don't know if widely popular is a fair assessment, but I appreciate it.
Let me ask you this. How many times do folks come up to you and say, hey, Sam, did you wash your hands? And you go, sit down.
My personal interactions with people are so few these days that I have not had that happen to me yet.
I hear you. Well, let's go back for a moment. Not that far. President Donald Trump announced at a press conference yesterday, I'm going to play a clip here, that the federal government is expanding testing capabilities nationwide. Take a listen.
Today, I'm pleased to report that we're announcing our plan to distribute 150 million Abbott rapid point of care tests in the coming weeks. Very, very soon. This will be more than double the number of tests already performed. And here is our plan. 50 million tests will go to protect the most vulnerable communities, which we've always promised to do, including 18 million for nursing homes, 15 million for assisted living facilities, 10 million for home health and hospice care agencies, and nearly 1 million for historically black colleges and universities, and also tribal nation colleges.
What do you make of that, Sam? 50 million tests.
I mean, I think this is something to note, right? First, it's important to know these are antigen tests. So the president there said rapid tests. The idea with an antigen test is that they're a lot quicker than kind of our tests that we've been relying on throughout most of the pandemic, but they're also a little bit less accurate, right? And there are some people who see a world where these kinds of rapid tests are used to help people make decisions about what they do each day, right? So in this situation, Rose, you or I would have access to this kind of quick test that could tell us, should I go to work today? Should I go to the store today? Mm-hmm. The president threw out some big numbers there. Georgia's initial allotment is going to be about 200,000 tests. That's what the governor's office says the state's going to be getting pretty soon. That's a number that's a lot smaller than those big numbers the president was throwing out. Just for a little bit of context here, 200,000 is only a little bit bigger than all the kids that are in the Gwinnett County School District, which I think is important for context there. The governor's office says we are going to get about 3 million tests down the road. But if we think about how these tests are going to be used, right, you don't just test someone once and then they have a clean bill of health for the rest of their lives. You want to be able to do this frequently. 3 million tests isn't a ton, right? And so it also depends on where these tests are actually deployed. The governor's office says more details on that will be made clear in the coming days.
And we should note, earlier in the year, there were some issues with Abbott's testing devices. Now, I don't know if it was the antigen test or it was the rapid, but I'm assuming they got all that figure it out, correct? What do you know?
You know, that was my first thought, Rose. Abbott, the lab, the diagnostic company that is producing these tests that are being distributed, people might remember they had an issue with one of their rapid tests. I think it was a different kind of test. It wasn't an antigen test. Mm-hmm. They had a rapid test deployed. There was one here in Atlanta at Georgia Tech, I believe. It had an issue with false negatives, essentially telling people they were not sick when they were, which if you think about how this disease spreads, that's a pretty bad thing. That's something that the FDA was investigating. I believe that investigation is still ongoing, but this is a different kind of test from Abbott. So I guess we'll just have to see what the false negative rates are. Again, we do understand that antigen tests are less sensitive than our kind of gold standard. This is the PCR test that people might have heard about. But the idea is that there's a trade-off there. It's less accurate, but it's quicker, right? And it allows people to maybe make quicker decisions about what they're going to do with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of the White House and their most recent White House task force report, now the latest actually ranked Georgia 23rd in the country for new cases. Here in Georgia, Sam, it looked like after stalling out for a bit last week, the state's coronavirus metrics are improving. So talk to our audience about the numbers that we're seeing and how Georgia is doing compared to other states.
Yeah, so Georgia does seem to be doing better as of late. I think last time we talked, Rose, maybe a week or so ago, some of our metrics were kind of stalling out, but the kind of positive movement that we had seen prior to that is continuing. And we actually got our hands on the latest report from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. This was put together on Sunday. We obtained it today on Tuesday. And the state of Georgia has actually left the red zone for new cases. That's the worst category. We also beat the national average for new cases for every 100,000 people by just a little bit in that report. So our numbers are getting better. These rankings, though, of course, are always relative. So Georgia is 23rd in the country as of Sunday when it comes to new cases. Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending on how much better or worse other states are doing, our ranking could change relative to that, right? And the pandemic isn't monolithic. As of late, we've seen other states in the country, specifically states in the Midwest, where the pandemic really seems to be taking off there, mm-hmm. in ways that it hasn't in other parts of the country earlier this year. So, you know, some states do worse. That makes Georgia look better just by comparison, but it does look like a number of Georgia's metrics are improving.
Well, after last week when we had the milestone in this country of 200,000 deaths, but now, as of the time of this broadcast, around the globe, we're looking at 1 million worldwide. And you're looking at the United States and then Brazil and India, and these nations continue to have an escalating percentage of confirmed cases. What do you make of this, Sam, that we are now at a global death toll of 1 million people?
You know, it's just kind of striking to think that this time last year, we didn't know that this virus existed, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the numbers, if you really stop to think about not only the 1 million people, but the 1 million families affected by this, they're pretty staggering. It's also important to know that there's a general consensus that our death counts are undercounts, right? So these are 100 million deaths that we've confirmed. There are other deaths that we don't know about potentially from COVID-19. Then you even have to think about kind of the secondary and tertiary deaths, people, you know, deaths of despair, people who have found themselves locked in their homes, maybe without a job, who turn to substances that exacerbate health issues, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the impact, I think, we don't have the ability to wrap our hands fully around it. When I hear these numbers, to think about in the U.S., how there's still a vast majority of us who haven't been exposed to this disease. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last week, said that his agency estimates upwards of 90% of the U.S. population has not been infected. And so if we think about this 200,000 number here in the U.S., that's only with 10% of the population roughly having been exposed to this thing. And mm-hmm. so if that many people are still vulnerable, it's not hard to imagine that number going way up.
Mm. And Sam, you recently spoke with Dr. Georges Benjamin. Now, he's the head of the American Public Health Association. And this is where we get to the intersection of COVID-19 and politics. He's calling for a, quote, reboot of how the country is handling the pandemic. What specifically is the issue here?
I think the issue is people in the public health world, like Dr. Benjamin, have said over the course of this pandemic that no outcome is inevitable. We're talking about these really big numbers today, 200,000 deaths, at least in the US, a million worldwide. That's a big number. Those are big numbers, but we still have the ability to provide, to create good outcomes here. And I think that's what Dr. Benjamin is really calling for here. We don't need to think these numbers are a sign that we should give up. This is far from over, and we really have the ability to make things better. So kind of the biggest thing that he and his group are calling in their letter they put out last week is really this separation of politics from public health. We've seen a bunch of notable examples recently of how President Trump and others in his administration have really tried to interfere with public health messaging coming from agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. And Dr. Benjamin, and quite frankly, a lot of public health experts are worried about what that's going to do to the faith that people have in public health messaging. And he thinks that's kind of square one. We need to decouple those things so people truly can trust that when they hear a message from a public health official, that that message is not political in any way. It's purely meant to improve health outcomes.
And I'm sure we'll hear a lot of this during tonight's presidential debate. Meanwhile, one issue that might come up is about a vaccine. Now we're hearing this vaccine may not even be available for people till way into next year. So what are folks like Dr. Benjamin and others, Sam, what are they saying about, are we on track to get a vaccine anytime within the next 12 months?
You know, Rose, I think there's maybe two ways to think about this. Progress on this vaccine is happening probably quicker than progress on any other vaccine has ever happened here in the country. And that's something that public health experts are really in agreement about, that we are moving incredibly fast to get something to market. That is very different from having a vaccine that is widely available to everyone, you and me. You know, we do have a number of vaccines in development that are in the later stage of clinical trials that look for not only safety of a vaccine, but effectiveness. Dr. Benjamin's take was that we should know the results of those trials early next year. Other public health officials like Dr. Tony Fauci have pushed that timeline a little bit closer to the present, saying that we should know results before the end of the year. But then again, we have to scale up production. We have to think about getting these vaccines, which are very sensitive items. They have to be stored and handled very particularly, very specifically, getting them out to a broad number of people. Realistically, the timelines that we're hearing from folks is that it's going to be into next year, into next summer, potentially into next summer and fall before they're widely available. Then you have to think about mistrust in a vaccine. Then you have to think about the fact that people just kind of aren't used to getting vaccinated for things, you know, and so the thing that Dr. Benjamin told me, which kind of struck me yesterday, is his take was that the world that we're living in now is probably not going to look too different after a vaccine. We're still going to have to wear masks. We're still going to have to think about socially, you know, physically distancing ourselves from people. His take was it could be 2 years from now before things really start to look like the world before the pandemic, as much as they do at all. You know, I think that the changes that we're going through, some of them aren't going to be reversed.
And finally, Sam, well, we're in that part of the year where the holidays are coming up. First Halloween, then Thanksgiving, and of course, you know, all the biggie in December. But listen, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last week releasing a guidance on how to celebrate safely. Halloween's going to be a little different this year.
It is. And these were guidelines that kind of made some waves in the, I don't know if you're on public health Twitter like I am, but, you know, even experts outside of the CDC kind of had some questions here. But the CDC's guidance is that trick-or-treating, as we normally think of it, is a high-risk activity. It's not hard to think about that, especially in neighborhoods where trick-or-treat gets really crowded. You know, a bunch of kids gathering on someone's doorstep, reaching into a communal bowl, you know, people packed on sidewalks. It's not hard to imagine that being a high risk situation. So CDC says, try to avoid it if you can. They also say costume masks are not effective at slowing the spread of disease in the same way that a cloth mask is. So don't assume that just because your kid is, you know, has a mask on that they can't be transmitting the disease. The CDC, though, does say that there are ways that we can do things safely. If we want to think about kind of big social gatherings like Thanksgiving, you know, the guidance they have for that is the guidance they've been giving out all summer for gatherings over different holidays. Try to do it outside. Try not to be around a bunch of people who aren't in your immediate household. Mm-hmm. Be really aware of how actively the virus is spreading in your community as you're assessing your risk. You know, if you're high risk, maybe skip out on stuff this year. So, you know, I think it's important to know that, yes, the holidays are going to look different. But honestly, Rose, I think it's more helpful for people to focus on not what's going to be different, but the things that we can still do, mm-hmm. right? The CDC does not say cancel Thanksgiving. The CDC says, how can we adapt Thanksgiving to this extraordinary time to make sure that people stay as safe as possible? You know, for me, someone who over the course of this pandemic, it is not hard to look at everything bad. I have a tendency to do that. For the holidays, I'm trying to look at the ways that we can still gather and think about what we can be thankful for.
Sam, you need my grandmother's sweet potato pie to make it all good.
It is the best pie. I will die on that hill. I will die on the sweet potato pie hill.
You are a good man. Sam Whitehead is WABE's health reporter and host of the podcast, Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam, as always, thanks for the update. We really appreciate it. Our listeners do as well.
Yeah, thanks, Rose. Good to be with you.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Well, tonight is the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. And just think, combined, they've only raised more than $2 billion in their campaigning. Now, here's the breakdown. According to FEC filings as of September 20th, Joe Biden and the DNC, well, they've raised about $990 million. President Trump and the RNC, $1.033 billion. Yes. Now, do voters care about how much these two have raised? Or better question, what exactly do voters care about when it comes to the big Tuesday in November? Are they fueled by these issues or their emotions behind the issues? Confused? Well, let's welcome to the program Drew Weston, Emory University Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry and author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And this is an era that Professor Weston has studied for decades now. Professor Weston, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Before we dissect the message of Trump and Biden, let's begin here because there was an article published just a few months ago. The author was a gentleman named Brent Buchanan, who wrote, quote, campaigns need to be paying attention to what voters are feeling, not just thinking. There's truth in that statement, Professor?
There's absolute truth in that statement. If you look at the elections going back from 1948 through the present, and you look at what are the best predictors of people's behavior, voting behavior, it is at the top of the list. It is their feelings towards the parties. Mm-hmm. The second is their feelings towards the candidates. Third is their feelings towards the candidates' personal attributes like honesty and competence, that kind of thing. Their fourth is their feelings about the issues. And the very fifth is what they know about the issues. And what mm-hmm. they know about the issues is way down the line. It counts for about 1% of people's voting.
And that's something you point out in your book, although it's been nearly 12 years since it's been published. But the core of this is, and I'm quoting you here, in politics, when reason and emotion collide, emotion invariably wins. So here's a question then for a listener who's driving around saying, okay, Professor, why? Why is that? Why does that happen?
It all really comes from how we evolved. When we evolved, we were, we evolved actually to link reason and emotion. But our emotions essentially picked up they give us the fuel for what we're going to do, and our reason sort of leads us in the direction of how we're going to get there. So for example, you know, when we were evolving, what mattered most was ensuring our survival and ensuring the protection of our kin, particularly our closest kin. And then third, what evolved was our concern for people in our group. Because we had mutual, what's called reciprocal altruism, or, you know, essentially we took care of each other, and by everybody doing that, that increased everybody's chances of surviving and their families surviving and then being able to have kids and those kids surviving. So, you know, when you think about what it is that makes us care about something, it is most of the time it comes down to some version of survival or our status. It comes down to our kids and our kin, our family, or it comes down to our love of community and care for community, and for concerns about people who aren't pitching in, like when we hear that the president only paid $750 in taxes, mm-hmm. that raises concerns, or, you know, concerns about protection.
Well, let's go back a little bit, because I can understand someone saying, okay, but let's go back. You mentioned 1948, but even decades before, I think it was it Calvin Coolidge who was the first president to have an address with the radio, or I have the radio installed in the White House. That was in the 20s? So one could say, well, technology, hasn't that played a part in how candidates or presidents are able to play on those emotions? You think about the fireside chats with President Roosevelt. People felt like they were connected to him. Like, he's really talking to my household. So what role does technology play in this, and being able to get this message out from these candidates, whether now, can you imagine if Calvin Coolidge had a Twitter account? I don't know. But threw that out there.
It plays a huge role. And in fact, you know, you often see that presidents who harness that technology to not only get their message out, but get for voters to get to know them or to feel like they know them, and have the sense of knowing what they feel, what their values are, do their values mesh with theirs. It really starts with FDR using radio, just as you're describing. I mean, those fireside chats, my mom was born in 1930, and she remembers her family huddled around the big brown radio that they had back then, and they would listen to him because he was like their father. I mean, she to this day idolizes Franklin Roosevelt, in part because of that, in part because of the way he made them feel that there was someone there who was fighting to make them safe and to put food in their stomach, but also because he actually followed through. And, you know, I think what we've seen over the years is that candidates who can connect with people at that emotional level using the new technologies of the time. Eisenhower was actually the first to harness television. Mm-hmm. And then Kennedy beat Nixon in a debate because of just the way he came across versus the way Nixon came across.
So it's not so much what the candidates are saying, but it's how they're saying or phrasing their message, and then the delivery medium that they're using, whether it's Twitter or, you know, Facebook or what have you.
I mean, there certainly are voters who are single issue voters, voters who say, if this candidate isn't pro-life, I'm not voting for him. There are certainly those. And, you know, we're seeing that around the new Supreme Court nominee and the right versus the left galvanizing around that. Typically, voters on the right are more likely to be galvanized by a Roe v. Wade decision. You know, voters that, although two-thirds of Americans support maintaining Roe v. Wade the way it is, the support is weaker from those in the middle and on the left than it is from those on the right.
Well, so
and it's really the power of emotion behind it that is the passion behind it. That is making Trump feel like this is a winning, Trump and McConnell feel like this is a real winning issue for them, even though only one third of voters are on their side on this, which is kind of a striking phenomenon.
So playing on the emotions of the voter, does that mean certain trigger words or phrasing that they evoke a particular emotion within that voter?
Absolutely. And I what I guess it's important to say is that, you know, there are you know, there's kind of two axes, if you think about it. If you think about one axis going up and one axis going across, like from geometry from ninth grade. Mm-hmm. You know, one axis is if you're sitting at a table, from the bottom of the table going up is falsehood to truth of your statement. The other axis going from left to right is how emotionally compelling it is, from not compelling to really compelling. And someone like, Donald Trump is a good example. I'm gonna be slamming Democrats in a minute, but I'll start with slamming Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is a prototypical politician who's in that quadrant of highly emotionally compelling, but untrue. I mean, he'll say anything, but he'll say it in a way that makes a lot of people feel it. Now, a lot of us obviously don't feel it, but a lot of people feel it. And he'll use trigger words like when protesters started to use on the left the phrase defund the police, mm-hmm. and when the Minneapolis city council picked up on it, it was obvious that he was going to use that in an ad. And he ran exactly the ad that I predicted he was going to run, that basically said Democrats want to defund the police. Mm-hmm. And then he showed pictures of the riots. And this is what happens when you defund the police. Now, that is, in fact, Joe Biden had disavowed the term defund the police and said, I don't want to defund the police. That's ridiculous. But I do want to reform the police. I mean, we can't have black men shot in the back all the time. That's not okay. We need to reform that. But and do we really need, you know, somebody is someone's drunk and asleep at the wheel at a Wendy's? He shouldn't end up dead out of that. You know, if you're going to do that, maybe we should have sent mental health counselors there the first time. So phrases like that make all the difference. But then if you go to the other quadrant, what Democrats do, and the, my worry, frankly, forewarned is forearmed. I do consult to Democrats, mm-hmm. My concern for tonight is that Joe Biden has been prepped, as we've heard, by getting briefing books in front of him over and over and over again, trying to stuff a bunch of facts at a 78-year-old man's head. Well, you know, that's not a great strategy. I hope that's not what they're doing, because that's what Kerry did. That's what Gore did. You know, that's what Hillary Clinton did. And compare that style to what Barack Obama and Bill Clinton did. You know, they weren't there in the debate to say, to speak the truth in a by blowing out a bunch of facts at you, because no one's interested in your fact collection. What they were interested in doing was, number one, make an emotional connection with the voter. Mm-hmm. Number two, picking a few key facts that they spoke in a compelling way. And number three, leaving people with a sense of hope. So I didn't mean to go on so long, but my point is that Democrats often think that that there's some kind of contradiction between speaking the truth and speaking in an emotionally compelling way. And so what they often do is they speak the truth in an emotionally uncompelling way. And what you really want to do is you want to speak the truth on either side. You want to speak the truth in a compelling way, because there's a compelling way to tell the truth from both value systems of the right and the left. You don't have to tell lies about it. And you also don't have to. So, you know, the Republicans' problem is they tend to tell lies about it. And the Democrats' problem is they tend to speak the truth, but to bore the hell out of people. So they're not interested in what they're saying, and they're not feeling a connection to either the party or to the person.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Drew Weston. He's an Emory University professor of psychology and psychiatry and author of the book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. So, Professor, after all of you said that, and I know there are some listeners saying, okay, well then, I consider myself to be an informed voter. How can I not allow their emotions to influence my choice? Or is it almost kind of impossible?
I would say it is neither possible nor a good thing. And what you don't want is, I mean, so, okay, so here's why I'd say that, is if you think about I say this all the time on in conversations with political leaders, mm-hmm. when they start talking about the reasons, you know, how it's all about reason. And you know, we're in an era in which emotion is being demagogued. You know, we evolved to have our emotions guide us towards things that are good for us and our families and our communities, and away from or to fight things that are bad for us and our families and our communities. And that in general leads us in the right direction. But it is possible periodically to have a leader who can fool most of the people enough of the time to get elected. And when you see that in a con man, that's when emotions lead us really astray. So, you know, most of the time, you actually, if you think of it, what's the difference between someone who's conservative and someone who is progressive? It's not just that they believe different things. It's that they care about different things. They care about different people. Like, why should I care that we have a just society in which it doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, or it doesn't matter what your national origin is, or if my kids have some advantages because they're white, why should I care about kids who are black? Well, you know, there's nothing rational about that. I mean, I guess, you know, you could make up a rational story about, well, in another 100 years, or, you know, another 20 years, you know, et cetera. But it's about our feelings about it. And if you don't have that feeling, you're not going to be guided in any direction by reason.
But in the space that we're in now, a pandemic, the social justice calls that are out there, obviously it's a political year. You're saying that the candidates, President Trump, Vice President Joe Biden, are you saying they need to change the way then they talk about either the pandemic or racism, and that could
absolutely
sway a voter?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So to give you an example, Democrats frequently use the word systemic racism. I actually counted the number of times they did it over the 4 days of their convention. And on one night of the convention, they used the term something like 15 times. Never once did they define it. Now, what the average white person hearing that, first of all, the average person, I teach at Emory, and I have good students, and I was teaching a class on a small seminar on the psychology of political persuasion, mm-hmm. in American electoral politics. And I asked my students, I had about 18, I did this about 3 or 4 terms in a row. What's systemic racism? What does that mean? And you know what? Maybe two of them took a stab at it and had some idea. But think about it for a second. The average American doesn't know what systemic means. And I'm not ragging on the average American here. I'm just saying, I mean, the average person cannot distinguish between systemic and systematic. Like, what's the difference between those two things? And I mean the average educated person. I mean, I've had JDs and PhDs say to me, Drew, what's a quid pro quo in the middle of the impeachment hearing? And it's like I wrote a piece for The Hill, and the title of the first sentence was, "Note to Democrats: Americans don't speak Latin." You know, call it extortion, call it bribery, call it something that they know. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, wisely went to calling it bribery. But if you say something like systemic racism, and you say it over and over, it's all that white voters hear is, I'm being called a racist, and they get defensive, and they don't know what the allegation against them is. You know, it's like, well, you call me a racist, but what did I do? I actually had I had someone say to me fairly recently, who's a really honest, moderate voter right in the center. She said to me, Drew, you know, I keep hearing about the systemic racism thing, and I went to one of my black girlfriends. I said, can you tell me what it is that I'm doing? Because if I'm doing something racist, I want to change it. And her friend said, you're not doing anything wrong. But the fact that the reality is, it would be so much more powerful.
You should have asked me, because I told her.
Exactly.
I could have told her what it is. Yeah, without a problem.
But
And Professor, as we wrap up, what's your response? Because I can hear someone saying, well, look, at the end of the day, Professor, do you agree that folks also, they can research and fact check these candidates too, or they just don't want to do it, or they're being lazy? Because look, in 2020, after 2020, if you still don't know what systemic racism is or the definition of it, or if you're still having issues trying to wrap your brain around all the inequalities and the disparities that have existed for centuries, then you're not a well-informed voter to begin with, and you have no intentions on being one anyway. Is that fair for me to say as a journalist? I don't know. Someone will send me an email, but hey, it's 2020. All things are happening right now. I mean, what do you respond to that? Someone says, look, come on, y'all. Educate yourselves. Regardless of the political affiliation, educate yourselves. Do your research. You got the internet. Y'all at home because of the pandemic, so come on.
Now, I'd say two things to that. One is that we are now in an era where there's uncharted territory, where there is so much false information that's getting out there. The first problem is we are in an era of disinformation where it is really hard for voters. You'll hear voters say things with just certainty, and they'll say, well, I read this. And they actually thought they were getting informed, but they're being disinformed. So that's the first problem. But you know what voters are really looking for is they're looking to answer two questions. And if they would stick to these two questions, they're not really that irrational. One is, does this person understand and care about people like me? Mm-hmm. And the second is, does this person share my values? And if you think about it, those aren't really irrational questions to ask. Those are the questions that educated voters ask. You want to know, does this person share my values? Do they care about people who are like me, but who don't necessarily look like me? If they don't, like I look at, and again, I've said it before, I consult the Democrats. You know, I look at Donald Trump and I say, he cares about only a segment of America. And I believe that Americans are all Americans, regardless of the color of the skin, of their skin, regardless of their national origin. So he doesn't care about people like me, because people like me includes people who don't look like me. That immediately wipes him off the slate for me. I don't care what his issue positions are, because I know his issue positions follow from those values or from that lack of values. And so if people focus on those two questions, which are gut level questions, I think that makes them pretty good voters by and large.
Drew Weston, Emory University professor of psychology and psychiatry and author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Professor, compelling conversation. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. On this program, you all know we've talked about food insecurity during the pandemic and how nonprofits and local organizations and businesses are trying to address this issue. But most recently, I spoke with Letitia Springer, who launched Free 99 Fridge. It's a mutual aid organization to fight hunger. And actually, earlier today on NPR, there was a segment about this. Springer's organization is installing community refrigerators throughout the city. It's where people can take food from the fridge at no cost. She said this when I asked her about the work that's being done to fight food insecurity right here in Atlanta.
So I think there are a lot of initiatives that are taking place in our communities right now that are helping to kind of end this food insecurity and abolish the food apartheid that's happening in our city. And urban gardens or community gardens is one of those things. And make no mistake, I think it's gonna take multiple efforts and initiatives to make this happen. Like, this runs really deep and is interconnected to a lot of other things, not just food. And so I think it's going to take the combined efforts of many initiatives to make that happen. But lots of good work is happening in our city around this area.
Well, now on to another initiative with the goal is to feed 1,500 families. It's a partnership among the Atlanta Community Food Bank, the City of Hayville, and Wells Fargo Bank. And joining me now to talk more about this is Chad Gregory. He's a Regent Bank president for Wells Fargo. Kyle Wade, president and CEO of the Atlanta Community Food Bank. He's been on this show many times. Todd Nichols, director of Hayville Parks and Recreation. Chad, Kyle, Todd, thank you all for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Morning.
Thanks, Rose, for having us on today.
Not a problem. I want to begin here because I was reading this report from the Brookings Institution, and it offered this. The estimates of income and poverty for 2020 will not be available until September of 2021. But what is clear is that COVID-19's economic impact on vulnerable populations runs deep and wide. Chad, I'll start with you. Your thoughts on this?
Well, COVID-19 has had a devastating impact on a lot of individuals and families in our community. And we're just trying to figure out a way to help. And so what we've done is really work and transform 20 of our locations across the country. So these are administrative buildings, these are parking lots, branches, operation centers, to turn them into food distribution centers. We're just trying to make it easy. So when families, individuals drive up, they can pop the trunk, we can provide them with groceries. And really we have a goal of providing 50 million meals to families in need. And so we know that during the pandemic, it has created a lot of financial instability for a lot of individuals and families, and making tough decisions with food and shelter and other basic needs. And we just hope some of these small efforts can really help during a very tough time for a lot of families and help them in need.
Well, let me move to Kyle, because Kyle, you of all people, your organization, you all are well aware for a long time now of the need for food. You heard what Chad said about the pandemic pretty much exacerbating what was already an issue for so many households, not here in Atlanta, but throughout the nation. Kyle, your thoughts on this moment that we're in with this pandemic and food insecurity?
Sure. And Rose, thanks again for shining a light on this problem in our community, and really a problem across the country. As Chad just said, COVID-19 has had a dramatic impact on increasing levels of food insecurity across the Atlanta region and more broadly. We think there are 50% more households struggling with food insecurity than there were prior to the outbreak of the pandemic. That means that more than a million people across the 29 counties served by the Atlanta Community Food Bank are often struggling to get enough food. We've certainly been able to grow our output to the community at the Atlanta Community Food Bank. We've increased our weekly food distribution by more than 60%. And over these last 6 months, we've provided already about 45 million meals to people in need across our community. Our ability to do that is a function of the partnerships that we've been able to build with the private sector, with the public sector, with nonprofits, getting distribution points stood up so that we can more effectively target those communities that have been particularly hard hit by this crisis. I think it's important to say that the challenges that these families face were already present. Mm-hmm. This vulnerability was already present prior to the crisis, and the crisis has just amplified that. And so the families that were struggling before are struggling now at an even deeper way. And this increased impact has in particular really affected communities of color and other immigrant communities, other communities that were already facing higher levels of vulnerability prior to the crisis.
Todd, what can you tell us about what's taking place in Hapeville? Have you all seen an increase in households needing assistance? I'm just curious about your region.
Yes, we've already been doing some projects. We started years ago doing the Toys for Tots, and the number that we see now coming in has tripled. Not only do you see the lower income families, you're also seeing middle class families that needs the help as well. We've been doing business with Atlanta Community Food Bank for the last 5 months now, and we've already distributed over 250,000 pounds of food. You see everything from lower class income families. You see $75,000 vehicles come through here, and they're all just very appreciative of getting the help. It's a big need within the community, and I appreciate the work that the Atlanta Community Food Bank does, and just very grateful of partnering with Wells Fargo as well.
Chad, let's go back to Wells Fargo for a moment. These programs have already launched, or they're already underway in other areas of the nation. How did all this come about, though?
We've been, in the past, we turn our retail branches into food collection centers. We have 150 locations in Metro Atlanta. We have 5,000 locations across the country. But in this pandemic, the need is there. And as your previous speaker shared earlier, It takes a village. It takes all of us. Todd was sharing with me yesterday as we were kind of volunteering and helping out families. We're doing this event to reach directly out to those families and individuals in need. Well, Todd and his Hayteville team has been doing this every week since 4, 5, 6 months ago. And Kyle and his team, we've been partnering with them for a year. So I think what we found is there was a big need. We have redirected, even at a company level, over $175 million just to help with food and shelter and those families in need, because we're trying to react and help and adjust based on how difficult this pandemic has been.
Well, let's take our listeners through how this will work, and either one of you can jump in here on this. So there'll be specific Wells Fargo banks where folks can drive in and pop the trunk. They will just be given some food. Is that how it works?
We've had 4 dates in the facility over here in Hayteville. Mm-hmm. We've done our second one yesterday. We have 2 more coming up on October the 12th and October the 19th, and it starts at 2:30. Line normally starts around 12 o'clock.
Really?
What happens is the food bank shows up with the truck. They unload all of the pallets and everything. My team breaks down the pallets, and we prepare for 300 to 400 families. And cars line up, and we have someone asking to open the doors, either you put it in the back door or pop the trunk, and it's just an assembly line. He just moved down the line, you put it in, and just say, God bless, have a great day. Chad took part of it yesterday, and I was happy he was out there.
It's a fun time. We're trying to just really make it a fun environment. But Todd and his team in Hayteville, from an execution standpoint, took a lot of time on preparation, gets everything prepared. But literally, you've got a line of cars, hundreds of cars that are coming in. And we're asking, do you have one family? Do you have two families? Do you have three families? And based on that, there are different stages. We say, you know, pull up to the next tent, and we give them their groceries based on the number of families they have. No questions asked. And as Todd mentioned, we've got 2 more dates coming up on October 12th and 19th. And it was just a great, great experience to be a part of that with those families yesterday.
And of course, the food is being provided by the Atlanta Community Food Bank. Kyle, this is something that you all do all the time. You all are part of initiatives like this. Let me shift for a moment. How are you all doing? Because now I imagine that you've seen a huge increase in the demand.
Absolutely. You know, I think what we've seen, as I mentioned earlier, you know, about a 50% increase in the food insecure population. We've grown our food distribution by more than 60%. We're distributing now on a weekly basis around 2.3 or 2.4 million pounds of food every week. And doing that across the 29 counties that we serve. We get that food out to the community through a network of partners. Mm-hmm. We've got partners who were with us prior to the pandemic, close to 600 partners who get food from us and then distribute it in the local community. In addition to those traditional partners, during the pandemic, we've stood up partnerships with other groups like cities, like Hayteville, the city of South Fulton, city of East Point, city of Atlanta. We're working with counties, DeKalb County, Gwinnett County, Cobb County. We're working with schools and school districts. We're working with industry like Wells Fargo, but we've also got a great partnership with the Hotel and Lodging Association, mm-hmm. just to find as many distribution points as we can across the community so that we can get food to those places where people really need it. And so for us, you know, it's been a complicated environment. We've had to adjust the way we operate, the type of distribution that we're doing with Wells Fargo and Hayteville, where people are driving through and getting food put in their trunks. You know, that's a socially distanced way of doing it. And it's helped us continue to get food out in a way that keeps people safe. We're not using volunteers right now in our building, mm-hmm. to minimize the risk of an infection. And so I think it's just been a really challenging environment. We've been blessed with tremendous support from the community and from our food suppliers to be able to meet the need. But we think this is a long-term challenge.
What happens after these next 2 dates?
You know, we're responding to the needs. I agree with Kyle. We've had a long-term partnership with Atlanta Food Bank for a decade, and it's going to be an ongoing need. We're continuing to redeploy resources, contributions, partnerships, nonprofits, We're going to continue to collect food, and we're going to add as many dates as we can. And in fact, we started off with 15 locations across the country that we were doing this food distribution. It's up to 20. And as of, I think, end of last week, we're up to 30 locations. So we're the demand is there. And we're having to increase our food distribution more and more just because more and more cities feels like it's a strong need there. So you're right. It is a we're in it for the long term.
Todd, do you have to be a I'm sorry, Todd, do you have to be a resident of Hapeville to receive the, the food?
No, man. We have a lot of residents from around our sister cities as well as different counties. We've seen tags from Bartow County. We've seen tags from Alabama. So it's not just the citizens of Hapeville. It's just the communities as a whole, because this is going to be an ongoing thing. You know, I don't see this ending anytime soon. And with the partnership with the Atlanta Community Food Bank, we're here every Wednesday. You know, every Wednesday they can pull up. We start handing out food around 2:45, and we feed between 300 and 350 families every single Wednesday. And it started off as just trying to help weather the storm back when the pandemic first hit. But right now, I see this is something that's going to go on for a while, and we don't plan on stopping anytime soon.
And we should note also, too, if someone knows of a neighbor or a family that might not be able to get out to Hapeville, perhaps be a nice gesture to drive out and pick something up for that household. Gentlemen, as we wrap
up. The other thing on that point, Rose, you know, there are people listening to your program all across Metro Atlanta. The partnership with Wells Fargo and the City of Hapeville is a great way in which we're serving people in that community, but people from other communities can find places to get help by going to the food bank's website, acfb.org. There you'll be able to put in your zip code and identify a food distribution point that's located close by. You know, this is as we've said, a massive challenge. We think food insecurity is going to be at elevated levels for many months to come, and it's going to take all of us. You know, Wells Fargo can't do it by themselves. Mm-hmm. The food bank can't do it by ourselves. We're going to all have to pitch in to help ensure that our neighbors have the food they need to survive and thrive in this very challenging environment.
As we wrap up, I want to make sure our listeners, again, if one of you all could share the date and the time again for the next drive-through to pick up the food.
Sure. October the 12th from 2:30 to 4 at the Hapeville location. It's the 3579 Atlanta Avenue there in Hapeville. And then the additional date is October the 19th from 2:30 to 4 at the same address and location.
You all talked about that this is an ongoing concern and issue. Do you see, though, expanding this program or extending this program for maybe just throughout the rest of October or picking back up in November? Is that possible?
It is possible. And again, we've already redirected that $175 million towards COVID-19 type initiatives. Again, we've already expanded from 20 sites across the country to 30. We already see, Todd and I saw yesterday, the demand. I mean, the cars never stopped coming. So we know the need is there, and we'll continue to work hard at adding more sites and partnering with the Atlanta Food Bank. Kyle and his team is fantastic. And Todd, he had his whole team out there yesterday. So yes, I see this only doing nothing but based on the demand, not only this year, it may even extend into next year as well.
Todd and or Kyle, you want to add anything to that?
Yes, City of Hapeville, we're here every single Wednesday. Food distribution begins again at 2:45, and we go until we're finished. I don't plan on stopping anytime soon. As long as Kyle and Atlanta Food Bank have us, we'll be here to distribute the food to the community.
And Kyle, you get the last word.
Yeah, well, I think we are planning at the food bank, you know, in the way that we're thinking about our fundraising, thinking about our food sourcing, we're planning to be needing to respond to this really elevated level of need beyond next year. You know, I think what we anticipate is that the sort of economic harm has been done and that there's going to be a lot of people who need support. So we're working now to make sure that we have the partnerships in place on the ground to get to help us get food out to people who need it, where they need it. We're working from a fundraising side to develop the resources we need to sustain this effort over time. And we're working with our food suppliers to make sure that We have a line of sight on the amount of inventory we need to meet the demand. But this is going to be an ongoing challenge. We're going to have to find as many solutions as possible. The lead in that you shared was a great way to think about it. There's not a silver bullet to this. We're just going to have to find as many resources as we can to meet really elevated levels of food insecurity for the next year. I'm optimistic we can do it, but it's going to require a lot of hard work from the food bank and many other partners.
Kyle Wade, President and CEO of the Atlanta Community Food Bank. I was also joined by Todd Nichols, Director of the Hapeville Parks and Recreation, and Chad Gregory, Region Bank President for Wells Fargo. Thank you all for taking the time to share this information. We'll have all this information on our website. And if someone didn't get the information, feel free to email me or call, and we'll provide all that information. And we should note also that the Atlanta Community Food Bank is a regular partner with WABE on food initiatives during our pledge drive. Thank you all so much. Thank you all for what you're doing for the community.
Thank you, Rose.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.